Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
The maps you've seen of America, they're wrong, or at least incomplete. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Until I picked up a copy of a new book by my guest for this hour, I had never thought about how important maps could be for understanding Black life in this country. Maps could depict not just where African Americans live, where they've come from, and when and why they move, but also what Black communities that are geographically distant from one another tend to have in common as incubators of social connections, culture, and power. And these maps also expand the parts of the country that can be characterized as the South. Spoiler alert, it is the whole country. Marcus Anthony Hunter joins us to explain. He's chair of the Department of African American Studies and associate professor of sociology at UCLA. His new book, written with co-author Zandria F. Robinson, is called Chocolate Cities, The Black Map of American Life. Marcus, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So the title of the book derives from a Parliament Funkadelic album of the same name that came out in 1975. What did George Clinton mean when he sang about a chocolate city, and what is your definition?
Yeah, one of the key lines from the song in 1975 Chocolate City is that he says, "We didn't get our 40 acres and a mule, but we got UCC." Hmm. And that for me and Zandri has always meant that he is, you know, talking about Black reparations, the idea that Black people are occupying space without waiting, that there was a promise made to them that would in many ways redress their many decades and centuries as enslaved people. And one of them would be a space or place to live. And what we hear in the song there, and we extend further in the book, is this idea that when Black people occupy and take up space, either by permission or without, there is a new formation that occurs, and that is a chocolate city.
So what makes any metropolitan area or section of one a chocolate city? Is there like a critical mass of population that needs to be there?
I love that question. And my response often to this is just borrowing from the Black Christian tradition, wherever two or more Black people are gathered, there is a chocolate city. Mm-hmm. And part of why I say that is because if we just think about recent policies that have been quite problematic and whose racial contours have been illustrated, I think, in popular conversation, for example, stop and frisk in New York City, that the idea for many of the police protocol was wherever two or more Black youth were gathered, there was some kind of formation going on, right? So the critical density or critical number of Black people, I think, needn't only be one or two people in order to constitute an apparatus of Blackness that now needs to be supervised or policed in a very serious sense.
Yeah. So you and your coworker started just talking about the ways that chocolate cities all over the U.S. function and what they have in common. Ultimately, you define the study of these connections as chocolate city sociology. So talk about what it takes to forge a new framework for looking at Black life in America.
The very first thing is the ancestors. Two is courage, you know, because part of one of the major problems I think that Zandria and I inherited as young sociologists is that we're already walking into a world where people have their minds made up about how to talk about particular phenomena. One of those being the social phenomena of Black people in dense locations across the United States. And that phraseology often is inner city, slum, ghetto, and concrete jungle. These are just some of the ones that we were forced to contend with even in our first books, hers being This Ain't Chicago and mine being Black City Makers, that we were having to confront, you know, a standing issue of vocabulary. And the issue with terms like ghetto or slum is that they only approximate a one-dimensional portrait of those communities and that they basically reflect that the state has failed Black people. So when we're thinking about a ghetto, it's about state failure, the opportunity to try to address housing shortages in post-World War II urban America, the opportunity to provide working class families with a nice and affordable place to live, that wound up being a colossal public policy failure. And as a way of marking that, we say, look at the ghettos. you know, look at the hoods, but we don't actually think about it from how Black people on the ground must be thinking about it, because a ghetto is a one-dimensional place of living. A chocolate city is a life world. A chocolate city is full of leadership and politics and culture, and yes, arguments and debates and discord, harmony as well, music, that there's so many other things that constitute Black life that I think both Zandria and I just thought, you know, if we don't, you know, just take the courage to say it and bring it out in the music and in the interviews and the day-to-day struggles that we all know and we all found in interviews, that we're doing, you know, our discipline a disservice, and we're also not lighting the way to the future, because I think in order to have better solutions in the future to some of these persistent problems of housing shortages, welfare, unemployment, is to stop using vocabulary or shorthand that has not paid off for us 50 years later.
Right. So even if Chocolate City is formed in response to the denial of resources and ownership rights in white dominated spaces, that doesn't mean that members of those communities couldn't find ways to make them places of power.
Exactly. And oftentimes what happens is if we don't include just that one piece that you just mentioned, part of what happens when we do our sort of ghetto style sociology or the sociology of the ghetto, it assumes that solutions on the ground are not happening and or not effective. So it removes the decision making from the actual residents and the community folks to people, as we think of on high, who then sort of make decisions for that population, assuming that they're not aware of their own issues on the ground.
You came to see Black as a country. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, that owes a direct shout out to the great scholar Nikhil Singh, whose book is of the same title, Black as a Country, where we're borrowing from Paul Gilroy, a scholar, a British Black scholar, whose book Black Atlantic was a great inspiration, and a bunch of other folks who basically try to expand what Blackness is. And for us, it really originates in Gwendolyn Brooks's poem Primer for Blacks, where she says Black is a word that brings in people. It brings in Black people here, there, or wherever they may be. It's a preoccupation. It's a title. It's a way of accepting and perceiving your glory and power. That in that way, what you arrive at is Black as a form of connection, not Black as a form of distinction. And there are distinctions among that Blackness, but I think what we're made to do is really think about how we're connected without even knowing each other. How are our conditions the same, even though they're in different regions of the United States? That kind of continuity and quality of character being consistent across place. I mean, our job as sociologists is to attend not only to distinctions, but also connections and similarities.
It also helps demonstrate that the assumption that the Black middle class has abandoned the Black poor is false.
Exactly. And our mentor at Northwestern, Professor Mary Patillo, is a big advocate of that exact thesis. Much of her work, Black Picket Fences and Black on the Block, really demonstrates this idea that unlike, let's say, the predominant majority white middle class populations, they're not Black middle class folks are not able or willing in some cases to move far away from their Black working class or poor neighbors. And so what you wind up having is that most all Black neighborhoods are more class diverse than folks often assume. That it's, you know, a neighborhood that includes not only a single mother, but also a welfare recipient, also a veteran who receives benefits, also a Medicare person who receives benefits, also a school teacher, a doctor, a lawyer. All of these people are part of the contours of an average Black community in the United States. But for whatever reason, when we think about a Black middle class, we kind of separate them and give them distance from their actual reality, whereby they're either directly related to people of different classes. You know, the school teacher's sister is a recovering drug addict. You know, they live a couple of blocks from each other. Or they also sort of think about them or class mobility as removing Black people from the realities that other Black people who are not middle class live through every day.
Is that a reflection of what's sometimes described as the fragility of the Black middle class?
I think so. I would also say that what studying Black America allows us to also see is that class isn't purely economics, but also social. Mm-hmm. You know, it reminds me of, for example, the great novel, The Great Gatsby, where a lot of that isn't just about Gatsby having a lot of money, but also about one's ability to perform the act of having money or social class. And I think what a book like Chocolate Cities is trying to demonstrate is that if we only focus on economic means as a way of understanding how Black people have class, then we're only looking at a piece of the picture, because then there's this whole thing of social class, where if you're in a community where we all know that there are glass and racial ceilings, that the school teacher who works at the high school or the high school principal might be the actual race man or leader of your neighborhood, even though in the larger scheme of things, if we were thinking about economically mobile people, a high school principal might be middling, you know, but in a Black neighborhood, that's the leader, you know. So it's also just to say that class is not just about how much money you make, but also your ability to, you know, be in dialogue with other places of power, to represent people's interests, to do it effectively, and also be a savvy politician in some ways as well.
Okay, Marcus, I want to talk about your conception of the entire United States as the South on a Chocolate Cities map. We in Texas are part of what you call the West South. The Northeast could be called Up South. The Midwest is Mid South. Why does the influence of Southern culture remain strong regardless of where Chocolate Cities are located?
Thank you for that question. You know, it really owes its origin to Malcolm X's 1964 ballot or the bullet speech, where he's in April in Detroit, and he says before the Black crowd, "Stop talking to me about the South. If you're below the Canadian border, you're South. If you're born in the North, you're born in jail, just like if you're born in South, you're born in a jail." So one, the South as an apparatus of anti-Blackness, white supremacy, and policing, you know, so the South follows Black people wherever they are. We think, for example, about how Black people leave a place like Texas for Los Angeles. And then we have myriad stories about the militarization of L.A. police, you know, which is not in many ways an accident, but instead connected to this idea of the South. The other point about it is that most all Black Americans in the United States have their origins in the states that we traditionally call the South, except when they migrate, in many ways, the places that they take up or create or the chocolate cities that are born out of that migration are not understood in that way that provides that connection. So one example I often rely on is when we have European immigration in the late 1800s to early 1900s, we're able to find that in many places across America because there are places called Little Italy. So we know that Italian immigrants arrived to the United States, preserved particular qualities of their homeland, home space, while also then assimilating or becoming American. But when Black migrants, who by the way are natural born citizens, are moving out of the traditional South to places like Chicago, they're instead just called the South Side, you know, or the Cabrini-Green Projects. It's not called Little New Orleans, you know. So we have no way of actually seeing how that culture travels unless you are a Black person in the South Side of Chicago, rotating in these sort of cultures, going past Harold's number 47 and meeting with your aunt who was born in the Mississippi Delta, who then goes back and forth every so often, the dialect being quite similar. So it's also a way to say that Black people bring their culture with them. And for many Black Americans, the origin of that culture is what we traditionally refer to as the American South.
Yeah, I thought I had a working understanding of the great migration of Americans, Black Americans in the mid-20th century, leaving the South for other places. I misunderstood the extent to which that migration has moved in both directions and has never stopped.
Yes, and this is this is why I say it takes some courage on our part, because one of the courageous things that we had to do is to take on the Great Migration. And part of why it takes courage is because in my assessment of American history and culture, it is possibly the only thing that we agree as a population of Americans that Black people have done historically that is great, you know, the Great Migration. So here we are writing about it, but then troubling the waters on it, in that what we're trying to say is if we only think about this period as the Great Migration period, we're then in many ways diminishing the intentions and motivations of migrants before 1910 and those after 1970. And we're also not allowing for the persistence of the need for migration for the same reasons, that the intentions behind the migration remain quite similar.
My guest is Marcus Anthony Hunter, chair of the Department of African American Studies and associate professor of sociology at UCLA. His new book is called Chocolate Cities, The Black Map of American Life. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We are at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
There's a lot of chocolate cities around. We've got Newark, we've got Gary. Somebody told me we got L.A. And we're working on Atlanta. You're the capital.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with sociologist Marcus Anthony Hunter. He's professor, associate professor at UCLA and chair of the Department of African American Studies there. His book is called Chocolate Cities, The Black Map of American Life. And you heard Parliament Funkadelic there to open up this segment. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. What about Atlanta? Marcus, you say people think of it as the mecca of chocolate cities. Is that accurate?
Yeah, you know, it's one of the things that we see if we take a long view of history is that chocolate cities have a way of being like Phoenix rising from the ashes. So they go through these life courses where at one point, you know, what we think of as modern day Atlanta was, you know, post-civil rights Detroit, you know, Motown Sound, one of the epicenters for the dissemination of Black cultural production. You know, we fast forward or rewind, we think about the Harlem Renaissance. So Harlem and Manhattan being this epicenter in the way that we think of Atlanta today with the variety of music folks like So-So Def and such. But also then we think about, you know, recent iterations like Tyler Perry Productions and a bunch of other reality shows that I think really try to illustrate black geography being centered in Atlanta at this particular moment. But I think Zandria and I's point would say is that this is just a historical trend. Right now it's Atlanta, but it's rotated from place to place over time. And perhaps that rotation is in effect a strategy of thriving and surviving.
One key concept of chocolate cities is the way they function as villages, places that facilitate really deep and important social networks. Is a chocolate city like a small town within a larger metropolitan area?
Yeah, I would say a chocolate city is back to the Black Christian tradition, wherever two or more Black people are gathered. So it's rural, it's urban, it's suburban. It doesn't take a lot for it to be constituted. And part of it just comes from a certain level of racial cynicism that you can find amongst white residents of major American cities and also major rural areas of America when we start to see what we call the Great Migration. And that, you know, once one Black family came, that was pushing the limit. But two, it's time to move. You know, so it's just to say that part of it is that the critical mass is in many ways really about two of anything, two Black women singers, you know, showing up at a gig, two Black women tap dancers showing up somewhere to perform, that oftentimes just those two people together have enough of the power and resources to generate a village of sorts of support. So we think about, for example, Black Hollywood, that you see a Black village come out to celebrate and support Jordan Peele winning an Oscar or Wrinkle in Time with Ava DuVernay, that there's a Black village, a critical density of Black entertainers who orbit in a world that whereby they are made to be a village of support for each other. And the number could just be 20 or the number could be 2,000. So I would say in many ways, it's not so much about the number per se, but just to note that it doesn't take a whole lot of Black people in order for something like a chocolate city to be realized. And the village is one of those very deep expressions. And as a way to explain that, we focus on a bunch of folks' lives, but one life in particular, that of Ida B. Wells Barnett, is super important because we see her rotating from a place like Holly Springs, Mississippi, so a small place, and then moving to Memphis up the river. And then from Memphis, we find her in Chicago and London and New York, and she comes with all of these different sensibilities, but having been reared in Holly Springs gives her a very different awareness about, you know, what it takes to be a Black community, what kind of ways are Black Black communities under siege. How vulnerable are Black populations? Because when you come from a small place like that, you know, where other places think about Bronzeville and Chicago as large, I think our sensibility would say that sometimes we allow size to convince us that we're safe. And when you come from a place like Holly Springs, you know, in the words of hip hop artist ASAP Rocky, it ain't safe, it ain't safe, it ain't safe, it ain't safe. So I think those small places also help engineer a political awareness about larger places so that people see more connections between Holly Springs and Chicago and not vice versa.
You also write about Zora Neale Hurston gaining an understanding of the village in her travels. She grew up in this small town in Florida, then she moved to Harlem. That had to have been a really interesting experience, a really interesting comparison for her.
Yes, and she also then, when she's in Harlem, receives a fellowship from famed anthropologist Franz Boas at Columbia University. And basically, he gives her the sum to travel through Black America, as it were, North and South, to figure out what is life like for folks. And she does a bunch of things. I mean, she's a very magical, hilarious, and profound person. And so one of her favorite things to do, for example, was to go from town to town and host a live competition, because her theory was that lying was how Black people managed to survive for so long, because they couldn't have been telling white people the truth or they'd be dead. So she thought, you know, lying is a skill that Black people have perfected. So she would have these open competitions, you know, kind of like hot dog eating competitions, where people would tell as many lies as possible. And part of what she was doing there was just to figure out how similar or different was Black life based on region and context. And what she writes back to Franz Boas is that she found that differences in geography were differences in sounds, because the sentiment was the same. That, you know, we sound different, our dialects vary, you know, our context might be slightly different, but the sentiment around Black life and the safety around it and the freedom aspirations of it were the same no matter where she went.
Does the village aspect of Chocolate Cities thrive? And I hope you'll understand that this question is not pro-segregation, but does it thrive despite the disadvantages of segregation or because of them?
You know, I think it's because and in spite of, you know. So, you know, part of what we learn from the Black freedom struggle is that there are many Black leaders who advocate and think about how Black people can be intermixed in the broader American society. And a story of America is in part about a rejection of that approach. You know, we have many leaders all the way through when we think about MLK and Jesse Jackson. You know, can't we all just get along? This idea that, you know, we can spread ourselves across the population if we're going to be treated as equal citizens and humans, and also it's safe. And so we've been struggling as a country to make that a reality for Black people. And so what I see as Chocolate Cities is also in the meantime, Black people have to keep on living, you know, while you're waiting for folks to agree that you're human and you're also a citizen. You have to keep on living. And that keeping on part of it is where you see some of the magic of the Chocolate City, because what it exposes is that, you know, a bunch of things about Black life aren't all about what white people are doing, thinking, or saying. Right. A lot of Black life is about what Black people are doing, thinking, or saying. And there are these critical moments where Black communities or Chocolate Cities are on white people's radar. Insert here Freddie Gray or Mike Brown, you know, so on and so forth. And then there are other moments where they're not so much on the radar. And instead, there are these fundamental conversations that are happening on Black people's radar. So I think it's also just the village is sort of what Erykah Badu, I would say, would call a frequency of communication, a frequency of existing, that the village is a very sort of the nucleus, the fundamental unit of Black existence, at least in this United States, where while you're waiting on Black people and white people to get to a particular place about Black freedom, they're still in the meantime living and in the meantime production and conversation and a bunch of stuff that Black people have to talk about amongst themselves. And I think one of those mechanisms is through the template of a Chocolate City.
So in writing about Chocolate Cities as incubators of the soul of Black life, these are places that have nurtured important artists. You write about Aretha Franklin, who grew up in the Mississippi Delta and in Buffalo, New York, and finally in Detroit. All these places had a role in her development as a musician. You note that initially New York record executives, who I gather at the time were probably a lot of white men, did not know what to make of her.
Mm-hmm. You know, Aretha Franklin is a really useful example. One, because she is the queen of soul. Mm-hmm. And I think when we're talking about soul, how can you talk about it without talking about the queen, you know? The other thing about Aretha Franklin is that part of why she is the queen of soul is because of that migration story of her biography. You know, when she does, for example, the album Amazing Grace, she does it with a black church in Los Angeles, you know, and for whatever reason, she's able to align her harmonies and her ideas and her mission with black life on the ground in black Los Angeles, a place very different from Detroit or Buffalo or Memphis. And I think a major part of it all is to say to folks that if we know that black people were enslaved and we know that there's a racial ceiling, that we know that unemployment is high, and we also know that entertainment has been one of the major vehicles that black people have had as a point of access or a point of sharing broad communication with each other. This is back to Parliament Funkadelic and the Chocolate City's idea of the mothership. You know, entertainment has been in many ways the mothership connection for black people across place, where you get to have Sammy Davis Jr. singing about something that loosely sounds like a song that everybody should like. But we argue that beneath that, it has to be up to multiple intentions because you have to communicate with other black people. So by virtue of her putting her experience into the music, that is where the soul is forged. She has to believe what she's saying and lay black life in it in such an authentic way that it registers with a troupe of a choir in black Los Angeles when they can sing in real time, and then for record producers and executives, and then for the black masses when the CD comes out and is shared with the world, that there's a way she has to wrap up a lot of things in very relatively simple lyrics. And so one of the challenges I would say for those who then read Chocolate City and think about the music and the film and TV that they watch is to really understand that black music, black cultural production is a multi-intentional template, a multi-purposeful template. It must accomplish multiple things at the same time, including and not limited to communicating with the broader black population.
That's a really tall order for any artist. Do you know, I mean, to what extent did Aretha Franklin go about that deliberately?
You know, I think part of it was trying out different sounds. You know, she's coming of age in a post-Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald kind of world.
Yeah.
And what we initially find in Aretha Franklin's catalog are attempts at a sort of Burt Bacharach, Dionne Warwick style music. One Step Ahead, later sampled by Mos Def on Black on Both Sides, is one of those classic examples of her trying out that sound. And she's amazing on the song. But for whatever reason, as the book details, it never quite strikes the same chord as Dionne Warwick with record executives. And so her search for sound in many ways opens up a new way for black people to sing. So she's combining blues and combining jazz and combining gospel and then putting some rhythm next to it and then introducing the world to this reimagined version of black music, which I think is, you know, not only an important marker for time and the musical genre, but also is a forecast for what happens in black music over time. You know, you need Moms Mabley and you need Ma Rainey in order to get Aretha Franklin and a Whoopi Goldberg. You know, like these things are about, in some ways, a baton passing around the genre. And Aretha Franklin's life really speaks to, you know, she didn't just wake up overnight with respect on her tongue. You know, that she had to travel and see a lot of black people, hear a lot of black things, conjure the black church, make it radio friendly, communicate respect, take it from a black man's perspective, manifest it into a black woman's perspective, and make it so that we can all sing along at the same time. Huge accomplishment.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Marcus Anthony Hunter, chair of the Department of African American Studies at UCLA and author of Chocolate Cities, The Black Map of American Life. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with Jay in Houston. Hi, Jay.
It's actually Dave, but that's okay.
Hi.
I'm trying to formulate a question, and I guess on your screen it's going to ask the author, you know, when he thinks prejudice will end, if he thinks it ends. My contention is it never will. However, I mean, the contributions of black Americans, it's enormous. It's enormous. You know, Black History Month will teach us that. as well as the new museum in Washington, which I hope to go to someday. However, I contend people of great achievement, of color, of great achievement, don't concern themselves with their color. They get on the hamster wheel and do what they have to do, and realize that there's going to be prejudice against obese people, black people, whatever.
What do you think about all that, Marcus? Thanks for your call.
Yeah, you know, I've come to the realization and the elevated consciousness that each of us needs all of us. And so I answer the question about the persistence of prejudice as the larger problem of humanity. You know, I mean, if we were to ever get right about race and black and white, it doesn't mean that other types, you know, won't continue.
We'll
like
think
women
of something
and men.
Else. Right,
right, exactly. And so I think that, you know, until we all accept whether our whatever our language is, our place of origin, whatever country we stand in right now, whoever our president is, that each of us needs all of us. I mean, this is one of the major lessons of Chocolate Cities, is that in order for that to thrive and survive, it needed every person. Every contribution matters. No contribution is too big or too small. And each of us needs all of us. And I think once we get to that kind of elevated consciousness, oh, what a world we might live in. And so I don't know if and when prejudice will end. I'm not an expert on the future, but I can tell you that the future is black. And in the future being black, we all need each other. And so my hope is that as we get closer to that kind of future, that people actually have an awakening to realize that there are less differences than there are similarities. And we ought to really focus on those if we're trying to make America a spot of freedom as it's supposed to be.
You describe Chocolate Cities as functioning as weapons of the weak in helping to cultivate and utilize political power. Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, I think it comes down to, and best crystallized in a film by Ava DuVernay, Selma, how this critical village of black people in, you know, Alabama, Selma, Alabama, you know, both represent the larger struggle, but then also the local struggle, also the municipal struggle to be seen as equal and also get freedom. That I think it's also really thinking about one of the major reasons why black people are gathered in density is because it's a form of safety and numbers, but also because there is this continuing quest for free space. And so because there is not a promise of free space among folks who are non-black and being black, the idea is that there is some element of that in an all-black space, that you can at least be free amongst each other. And this is why I say the Chocolate City is also a template to try to get at some of the fissures that divide black people, because what we often find is that even in all-black spaces, some black people are not free.
My guest is Marcus Anthony Hunter, Associate Professor of Sociology and Chair of the Department of African American Studies at UCLA. His book is called Chocolate Cities, The Black Map of American Life. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or go to Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the chair of the Department of African American Studies at UCLA, Marcus Anthony Hunter. He's co-author of a new book called Chocolate Cities, The Black Map of American Life. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Will you tell us a little bit about Marianne Shad Carey?
Yes, thank you for that. Marianne Shad Carey was born before the Civil War and also was raised in Delaware, Wilmington, Delaware, to be precise. She's a black woman who was born to a family of abolitionists who then had her schooled in Amish school in Westchester, Pennsylvania to protect her because at the time, Delaware was a slave state. And so we tell her story in Chocolate Cities because she represents, I think, one, someone who a lot of folks don't know but should know. She's one of the first women to receive a JD in America. She's also the first woman to run a major newspaper in North America. She was the head of the Provincial Freeman, which was out of Canada for a number of years. And so her story is really one about fighting against slavery and being an abolitionist. Once she gets of age, she returns back to Delaware, picks up the work. And in 1849, she's really fighting the good fight. But then at the top of 1850, you have President Zachary Taylor sign a new robust fugitive slave law, which made it not only the federal government's oversight to return slaves back to captivity, fugitive slaves to captivity, but also made it so that it could be an individual agent of their own choosing, which makes it an even more dangerous place because any old white person could just decide that they are a slave catcher. If you look close enough to the photo, and photos are bad now in 2018, imagine them in 1850 of what a black person who's escaped looks like. And you could use that as a way to snatch someone up. We think of 12 years a slave, and we talk about that a bit in the book, and the experience of Solomon Northrup, who's all the way in northern New York, and then taken into the Deep South into 12 years of slavery based on the idea that he was a fugitive slave, which he wasn't. And so she absconds to Ontario, Canada, and lives in Windsor for a number of years, and then becomes a part of a black village in Chatham, Canada, along with Martin Delaney, the first black man to receive an MD from Harvard, and goes on to become a recruiter for the Union Army. And is a big proponent of using her magazine as a way, or her newspaper, I should say, as a way of advocating for black people to migrate out of America altogether, as a way of making America know the contributions of black people and also underscoring the lack of safety. And so we focus on her a lot because as a black woman, she's not only thinking just about being put back into slavery, but that rape and all sorts of other types of sexual violence were often besieged upon black women in ways that even black men had not needed to ponder, even though you're going back to the same institution. So for her, the 1850 Slave Act was a serious violation that only the removal of yourself from the nation state would prove its violation. And so she lives expatriated for a number of years and returns once the Civil War is on the horizon to recruit for the Union Army. And by the end of the Civil War, we find her in Washington, D.C.'s U Street Shaw neighborhood, a very notable, important black historic neighborhood there, where she finishes the rest of her life as a student and then later a graduate of Howard University Law School.
Yeah, reading her amazing story, I have to tell you, Marcus, I wondered why she's not better known. And I figured it might be because it's hard to reduce her life to a single sentence, all the things that she did.
Yes. I mean, she is a wonderfully dynamic person and extraordinary. So I often think when we're finding, you know, black folks of the past and we go to ourselves like, why don't I know about this person? Which is exactly what happened for me, is because they were just that extraordinary, that our basic tools for keeping history alive just aren't always adequate enough to keep extraordinary black people on the consciousness and tell their stories in a way that they should. But I think that her story is really one is also representative of many stories of the era. You know, you have a fugitive slave law that just means that, you know, black people who are actually born free, as it were, don't have the safety and security of just being able to walk around in allegedly free states, because now the fugitive slave ability, the fugitive slave law gives the ability of individual contractors to snatch you up, you know, and take you somewhere. So it's deeply unsafe to be out by yourself as a black person in public in any place in the United States, let alone the traditional South.
So if it's not clear to people, you're not saying here that every Chocolate City is identical. They have things in common, but they have individual features. Talk a little bit about a place like Harlem, which you describe as one of the country's most diverse chocolate cities, to the extent that people living there today hail from, black people hail from all over the country and all over the world.
Yes. You know, when we say Chocolate City, part of it is also to say, you know, you have milk chocolate, dark chocolate, bittersweet chocolate. That chocolate itself as a metaphor really helps characterize the contours of diversity of Black people in America. So much so that a place like Harlem, which has a tremendous West Indian population and also a West African population that are a part of the Black world of Harlem and thus making a contribution to that world and becoming a part of that chocolate city are important. So it is to say that Chocolate Cities is really a way to also highlight the diversity of Black people in the space. That when we think about chocolate, you know, chocolate comes in different iterations and colors and taste profiles while still retaining itself as chocolate. And Chocolate Cities do the same work, that they can look different and feel different and even taste different in profile, but still be up to the same kind of work.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you'd like to join the conversation. Next on the line, we have Luis in Urban. Hi, Luis.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I really appreciate the topic. It is a really great topic. I'm a chocolate guy. I have 15 years in the country. I'm coming from South America, and I really believe there's a lot. I'm understanding that the main reason for this research is to find ways to help and support to these chocolate groups or cities to develop their potential. In that line, the question I have to Professor is, why is that most of the chocolate people, as soon as they become successful, either with money or fame, they move out of their places to different other places where if they stay in the same place, in the place where they belong to, or chocolate place, they will be able to become a role model for those who are looking for, who do not have that role model to become successful too.
Luis, thank you so much for your call.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Luis. I think, well, one, we were visiting earlier that Professor Mary Petillo's work shows that Black middle-class people aren't necessarily moving at such a rapid pace away from poor and working-class Black communities. But that being said, for those for whom I think Luis is asking about who do, I think the first thing that we see is because of the racial apparatus that is America, that even if you are a Black dentist and then you decide to move into a historically white neighborhood, that you should not be surprised to see that there will be racial turnover. So it's also just to say for those who often aspire to find white places, which oftentimes the idea is that you want to have a part of that dream as well, or what Du Bois called the American assumption, you know, like you want to have that as well. And so the movement isn't a problem, but what does happen is the reaction to that Black movement is often very much the same, where all of a sudden, maybe you were the first Black family in that neighborhood, and soon after there are two, and then there are three, and then there are less white families. So there is a way that a lot of times chocolate cities aren't not just necessarily this proactive creation of Black people, but in many ways, the consequence of Black people being anywhere in a large or small enough number.
Talk a little bit about gentrification and whether chocolate cities should try to fight it, should find ways to live with it. I mean, what should a chocolate city do as it begins to gentrify?
Yeah, that's a great question. This reminds me of work by a colleague, Derek Hyro, on Cappuccino Cities, which focuses a lot on the U Street Shaw neighborhood from Marianne Shad Carey's neighborhood, and it's changed into like a cappuccino city. You know, its chocolate is melted such, you know, that it is very creamy, you know, and such. That I think with chocolate cities, that the best example or metaphor I have is the sort of phoenix, you know, idea that it's this burning fire of a bird, beautiful, and it's blazing until it can't anymore. And then once we think it's dead, it pops up somewhere else. And gentrification for me is a part of, you know, the attack on the phoenix and part of why we see it being snuffed out. And I often encourage my students, because I think gentrification, you know, has this idea of gentry in it and these other things, that oftentimes some gentrifiers are actually poor whites. You know, it's not always, you know, white folks who have means, but it's really a form of dispossession. And that is to say that in neighborhoods that Black people were living that were previously seen as subprime areas of the city are all of a sudden miraculously overnight re-envisioned as a place to live, a place worth putting resources, a place worth, you know, raising your family and putting your kids in public school. That I would say is the Jedi mind trick of of it all. That when it was all black, it was the slum and a ghetto and a hood. But when it's starting to get, you know, what we call gentrified or dispossessed, all of a sudden it has a Whole Foods that it could have never had before. All of a sudden there are banks, you know, for people to go to. All these things are not sudden, but instead I think based on a series of racial logics about the geography of power and access. And for whatever reason, the geography of power and access never really overlap or align with the geography of blackness. And so what I would say to that is when we're seeing these kinds of practices, it's because all of a sudden people see the chocolate city. You see it now. You see why black people have been loving it, you know, living where they have. It's not so much a slum anymore. It's now prime real estate.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Okay, back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Felicia in Beaumont. Hi, Felicia.
Hi, how are y'all?
Very well, thanks.
I was going to ask a question. First, I'm very honored to speak to both of you. I'm an avid listener. My question is, how do you perceive the chocolate cities and the current things that are going on as far as Black Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter, all of the things that are going on recently, even with the Black Panther coming out, because that's been such a big thing.
Thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, thank you, Felicia, for the call and for being an avid listener of Think. I would say, you know, we have a chapter in the book, chapter 7, called Making Negro Town, which borrows from the skit Negro Town by Key and Peele in their final season. And in Negro Town, there's this incident where a black man is being accosted by a police officer and then taken to what is called Negro Town, a place where black people can hail a cab, where people, you know, are all brown and black, where black people, all of the movies are black. There's a movie theater for black people. All of the singers are black and they're literally dancing in the street. And, you know, in this current moment, this is one of those things where I see chocolate cities in real time. So, for example, the TV show Atlanta, Donald Glover's show, as like chocolate cities in real time. Or from Black Panther, Wakanda as the ultimate Negro town. You know, this place where people have freedom, black people are free. Or, you know, shout out to Coming to America, Zamunda. These sort of like ideas or imaginary spaces where black people are free, whether it be in Africa or in the American South. But it's really this idea that black people are in a place where certain types of realities that we often attribute to the black experience or the deficits of it are instead refashioned as assets. And so I think it's very relevant for now when we see folks online in Wakanda, hashtag, where people will then propagate particular types of, you know, imaginary freedoms that in Wakanda, black people can get a home loan. You know, in Wakanda, black people can send their children to public school and they go on to Harvard. So the idea is that in a Negro town where some of these things are taken away that are deficits of the black experience, all we see are the assets, which is a brand new way to see it. And I think what better time than now to really think about the lessons and assets of the black American experience than a time where we're probably at a fever pitch around racial conversations and such. And on the Black Lives Matter point, I think Black Lives Matter and the instantiation as we see it is really a reflection of black people talking about wherever black people are. You know, not just urban black people, not just suburban black people, not just black people in America, but black people everywhere, that their lives matter.
Very quickly, knowing the importance of chocolate cities to black culture and power, what does it mean for a black American to grow up outside of these spaces? And I take your point that, you know, anytime two black people are together, it's a chocolate city. But you know people who have, you know, mm-hmm. been the only black kid in their high school or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, this is where I think the soul portion of the concept of chocolate cities is important, is that even if you are, you know, growing up black in a predominantly white space or white neighborhood, that this is where the culture really is important, that you're then educated about blackness through the dissemination of cultural products like music. So you might learn about your blackness from Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, James Brown. Or you learn about your blackness from, you know, Lady Sings the Blues performed, you know, by Diana Ross in the Oscar-nominated film. Or you learn about your blackness from Claudine and Diane Carroll. Or you learn about your blackness from a Tyler Perry production. That there's this way that cultural production, I think, affords a window into the experience, even for those who currently are not surrounded by all black people.
Marcus Anthony Hunter is chair of the Department of African American Studies at UCLA and co-author, along with Zandria F. Robinson, of Chocolate Cities, The Black Map of American Life. Marcus, it's been really interesting. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you as well.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Our Twitter handle is at KERA Think. You can find the podcast with any podcast app. You can also get archives of the show at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.